Our next section here that we're going to talk about, next section or series of topics in Proverbs. And again, there's overlap with these. So again, some of them fit into the avoiding ruin, ruin category. But this one is what we're going to call interfacing with the world. Now, if you remember yesterday in our introduction, one of the things we said was that the father desires for his son to grow up to be a person of influence, of power, of property, of wealth, of honor, a family. He wants his son to be a powerful, influential person. And how do you do that? How do you become a powerful, influential person? Well, you have to understand how the world works. Okay, so the word interface. What's a realm where we often use words like interface? An interface is for technology, right? We often talk about that. So what's an interface for? Technology is how I, the user, use this technological tool. How I can use it to accomplish a task, right? So the world is what we're using in order to accomplish, you know, these things that make us people of power and influence, etc. So you see this all the way in the book of Genesis, where God creates our first parents, Adam and Eve, in his own image, and he creates them to have dominion over to rule the world that he's given. So in other words, Adam and Eve are supposed to interface with the world. They're supposed to be able to kind of grab hold of this world and make it do what they want it to do. How often do you feel powerless in the world? Like you're like, I don't know how to adult. I don't know how to make this world work. I can't make anything do what I want it to do. And everything feels like, you know, you feel like you're just going from one crisis to another and everything's sort of crumbling around you. It's like, yeah, that's not the way the Father wants the Son to live. I often live like that, and probably you do too, but that's not really the Father's ideal for his son. He wants him to understand how the world works. Again, Proverbs is always blowing the fog away so that we can really see how the world works. We always say, oh, that's how the machine works, and then we can actually use it. So I'm going to show you four topics here, and I'm going to mention this before I forget, but on page 6 of your handout, there's a list of questions that can be asked for all of these topics that we're looking at. We're looking at a total of 10 topics. We've already looked at 3. We're going to look at 4 here in this session and then 3 in our last session. But those questions on page 6 can go with, they're kind of food for thought or for thuth, as we just saw on the questions on page. They're food for thuth. And you can, the questions on page 6 can go with any of these topics. And maybe the next session I'll go through those real quick with you. But I'm going to try to stick to the script a little closer for these four, because we have 4 topics to get through, and we want to actually do them all. So this says session 3, 10:40 to 11:35. So I don't think that's, we'll stop at 11:35 though. That's what we'll do. Because it starts early. Thank you, Roddy. Appreciate it. Let's turn to chapter 23, verse 4 and 5. The first topic we're going to see under this heading of interfacing with the world is money. Proverbs chapter 23. Proverbs, of course, has a lot to say about money. Proverbs chapter 23, verse 4 and 5. Do not toil to acquire wealth. Be discerning enough to desist. That means know when enough is enough. When your eyes light on it, it is gone. For suddenly it sprouts wings, flying like an eagle toward heaven. Okay, so Proverbs, again, there's a few areas like this, like we just saw about alcohol, where generally the whole Bible is pretty much neutral or very positive about alcohol, and then the book of Proverbs has all these like, oh, be careful, warnings about alcohol. It's what we're going to call a minority report in Scripture. And Proverbs is great because it gives us a view like this on several topics. One of these is about money. If you read the whole Bible, what would be the general vibe about money? It'd be the opposite of the alcohol, right? Like, be like, money's bad. Money's the root of all evil. Like, money's going to ruin you. But you read the book of Proverbs and generally like, yeah, money's pretty good. Get as much as you can. Like, it'd be better to be rich than to be poor, right? So there's a general. So Proverbs is a little bit. It's providing sort of a, I wouldn't say a counterbalance, but it's a more universal look at a topic like money. Proverbs seems pretty pro-wealth. In other words, we may have a mistaken impression from the rest of the Bible that poverty is an ideal for which Christians should strive. Now, I don't know how else to put this, but except that I read a lot of books, and maybe you have too. There's a lot of guilt among American Christians that we're not poorer than we are. Because if you read the New Testament, it's very obvious that our brothers and sisters of the first century were quite poor. And though not all of them were, it's important to notice, not all of them were. And the Bible has very strong warnings for the rich. And so you can read all those things and you can start to feel guilty that we don't have it worse than we do. Like, just the same way you can feel bad that you're not, like, I literally meet Christians who feel bad they're not being persecuted more. It's like, you're not supposed to look for persecution. As Christians, we're supposed to be ready for persecution to come. Always ready for persecution to come. And yet also not necessarily hoping that it's going to happen. Like, we don't want it to happen either, right? Same thing. As Christians, we are always to be ready for poverty. Ready for poverty, but also I'm not aiming for that. I'm not aiming to be persecuted. There's no like persecution is not a moral good. Poverty is not a moral good. And I would say also, it was not possible for the writers of the Bible in the first century, for the disciples of Jesus, to imagine 21st century America. It's not possible. Like, it was not possible for people to imagine a society like ours with the like abundance of wealth that we have today in this country. So we have to be very careful as we think about how these things should apply. So money, what is money actually? You know, if you could really sit there, think about it for like, what is money actually? Money is a tool that we use to shape our world. So let me tell you a couple things that we do with money in the book of Proverbs. The first thing is we scorn money. And this is where Proverbs is most in line with the rest of the Bible. Like, as Christians, we scorn it. We don't think of money as being this like all important thing that most of the people in the world tend to. We just have a low opinion. We don't tremble before it. Again, when you start off with a fear of the Lord, it's really hard to fear other things. You got to choose your fear. Like, if you fear the Lord, you know what's going to happen? You're going to start fearing other things a whole lot less. If you set the Lord to the side and don't fear him, if he doesn't loom large in your view, like we talked about last night, if he's not so big, then money's going to seem like a really big deal. When God's a really big deal, money don't seem like that big of a deal. Okay, so we scorn money. We don't tremble before it, right? We're not slaves to it. We don't make all of our decisions based on it. We make decisions that, you know, normal people who are just trying to make it wouldn't make. Second, we conserve money. This is also another thing Proverbs says. We conserve it. We don't waste it on vain shows. This is what if you read those Proverbs about money that I've listed for you, one of the things he's like, don't waste money trying to impress people. Right? You don't have to trade up. You don't have to level up. You don't have to update. You don't have to have the thing that everybody else has, right? So that's a key thing. It doesn't mean that we don't enjoy money, but as Christians, we can endure. We should be empowered by God's Spirit to be able to endure discomfort. We also want to stay robust, because we put this piece together with the topic we were just looking about stranger danger, about being aware of the dangers of this world. As Christians, we want to stay sort of financially robust so that we're able to deal with a recession. Or we're able to deal with losing our job unexpectedly because we took a stand about something. Like, so we want to be prepared for that. There's a lot of Christians like can't take a stand they ought to take because they've been too busy wasting all their money on stuff they didn't need, and now they can't afford to lose their job. Or they've got a payment on something, and that's causing them not to stand fully in their convictions. Okay. The Proverbs also teaches about what today is called the treadmill effect. The treadmill effect describes why rich people are so miserable, right? Because when you're rich, you're expected to do all these kinds of things that rich people do that generally you don't want to do, but you have to do them because you're a rich person now. And that's why rich people often do not have a corresponding increase in their happiness. So Proverbs actually warns about the same thing. So we scorn money, we conserve money. The third one, we unleash money. We are conscious of how our spending affects other people. So in Proverbs is not opposed to saving, and it's not opposed to spending. It's for both of those things. But what it is for is using your money for godly ends. Okay? And let me give you one example of this. As Christians, we should have the strength to boycott. A strategic thing that you can do with your money is to not give it. This is what we were just talking about pornography a minute ago. It's like one of the really great things you can do with your money, one of the ways to unleash your money is to not spend it, not give your money to people that stand for things that are repulsive to you as a Christian, right? I grew up in the 90s, and that was the time of the great Disney boycott of the 90s. You guys ever heard of that or know about that? So the Southern Baptist Convention, which is the largest, you know, evangelical Christian denomination in the country, many other denominations joined with them, had a boycott of Disney. So like when I was a kid, it was like, no one was allowed to go watch Disney movies. Like it was a common thing. Like tons of Christians were like, no, we don't go watch anything made by Disney. Now it was hard because back then Disney didn't own literally everything. But now they own everything, so it's much harder. But what I find so strange, again, my point here is not to say boycott Disney or boycott any particular company, but I would say probably be a good spiritual discipline for you to just choose something and boycott it. Steph and I, we boycott a couple things. Now there's a lot of other things I see, like it'd probably be good to boycott that too, But let me tell you why. Like that's a strategy. A strategy as we wage war against the increasing darkness in our culture, right? You understand that the companies that we see that are, let me give you an example, companies that are promoting incredibly destructive transgender ideology in our country, why are they doing that? Do you think the folks that, like I literally, we bought some, exactly right, it's money. Like, do you think the people at the white cheddar popcorn factory are like, you know what, we just got to show our solidarity, Valentine's Day is coming out, we need to show our solidarity with all those transgender kids out there? No. They're making a gamble that the consumer is more likely to buy the bag with the rainbow on it than the bag that don't got the rainbow on it. That's the gamble they're making. And as Christians, we're the suckers if we don't make them choose. They are literally aiming for like 1% of market share with that. And we Christians, 40% of market share, we're not going to care what's on the bag. We're just going to buy it anyway. We're not making them choose. Boycott is saying, no, you're going to choose. It's going to be the rainbow or it's going to be us, right? One or the other. And so that's just one example of ways that we can, as Christians, we can think about unleashing. Remember that your money is turning gears in the world. Now, you're not responsible if you're ignorant about stuff. Like there's like, you know, you're not totally responsible for everything that happens because you spent your dollars. But that's totally different when you know what's going on. And we should try to use our money as a tool. Okay, that's enough about money. So money, that's the way to interface with the world. That's the way to get strong. It's the way to change, to take dominion or to take control and to exercise dominion of the world. Next one is our relationship with authorities. We'll go fast on the next three. Go to chapter 21, verse 1. Chapter 21, verse 1. The king's heart is a stream of water in the hand of the Lord. He turns it wherever he will. Okay, so God's got the king's heart in his hand. Jump down to chapter 28, verse 2. When a land transgresses, it has many rulers. Do we have a sprawling bureaucratic class in our country? Yes, we do. But with a man of understanding and knowledge, its stability will long continue. Okay, so how does government fit into Proverbs' view of the godly or the powerful life? So God has made us to look to leaders for help and for protection. We are quite wrong to imagine that we can be autonomous. Now, our leaders in history, historically, leaders of a nation can be so bad that we rebel against them. But when we do that, we are not choosing the best. Or what I mean is we don't think that's an ideal. The ideal is a peaceful land with good, wise rulers. Rulers can become so bad that the citizens are justified, I think biblically, in rising up and rebelling against their leaders. But to do that is to say, I am forfeiting any hope of getting certain blessings. Like I'm not going to be, we're just going to do without these blessings. Things are so bad that we're making a gamble. We're making an exchange. So we're just going to give up any hope of getting blessings that come from leaders. Okay? The king in the book of Proverbs is supposed to be sort of an exhibit of the power of wisdom. Okay? The king is, this is the standard by which we choose leaders when given choice. Now, We have to be careful how we read and interpret what the whole Bible says. There's really a real lack of sophistication among American Christians when it comes to this. We read the like Romans 13. You know, be subject to the powers that be, right? You know, honor the emperor. Scripture says it's like, okay, it's not a one-to-one relationship of honor the emperor and honor the president of this country. It's not the same thing. The most simple explanation of all is like, you don't get to choose the emperor. And if you say you don't like the emperor, he's probably going to chop your head off, right? And in this country, where we have a lot of freedoms, and in a democracy just works a lot differently. Because really what we have in democracy is a sharing of power, where everybody has a little piece of the power, right? So as you read the book of Proverbs, remember, you're supposed to be a king. The proverb, when you read these proverbs about kings, they're telling you two things. Number one, how you ought to be a king or a queen, and how you should respond to those who have power over you. So, but part of interfacing with the world is knowing how to deal with authorities. Have you ever met somebody, a friend in your life, has an authority problem, and their life is always a disaster because they simply don't know how to, like, deal with authority? Right? That's what the father's telling the son, like, dude, like, I want you to be a successful person of power. That's not going to work unless you know how to deal with a person who's like a king, a person who has authority over you, okay? So let's see. There's a couple other things about that, but I think we could probably move on. Proverbs does recognize how bad leaders can be, but generally there's an overall, I would say in Proverbs, the perspective of Proverbs, there's sort of a, the book of Proverbs is very pro-king. Doesn't have a lot of bad words about the king to say. It's generally like the king is like God's servant and you can trust in him. Now, again, that doesn't mean that you should go out here and say, well, I can trust our country's leaders because the book of Proverbs is very positive about leaders. This isn't just any country. What country are we talking about? We're talking about Israel. Who is their king? The king in David's line. Okay, you got King Solomon as the president. Okay, then I'm willing to talk to you about that. You know, that I'm going to have a very different view about that than I have right now. Right? We don't have, you know, until Jesus is the king or Jesus is the president of our country, like, it's all fair game. We can talk. But anyway, some of those notes in Proverbs, the very pro-king kind of message in Proverbs, should remind us, like, yeah, it's the king of God's promise. It's the king in David's line. It's the king is not a generic concept for Israel. Okay, that's fifth topic. Let's jump to the sixth. Our speech. Proverbs has a lot to say about speech. Let's look at chapter 18. Verse 21. Death and life are in the power of the tongue, and those who love it will eat its fruits. Okay? So God wants you to be a king or a queen. You know what a king or queen needs to be able to do? Talk good. You guys ever seen that movie, The King's Speech? Now, if you haven't seen it, or it's been a while, I would encourage you to go back and watch, even if you've seen it before, go back and watch after you've thought about this, about what Proverbs has to say about this. And it's really powerful. Here you have the King of England during the war era, World War II era, Queen Elizabeth's father. And he had a fairly serious stutter, fairly serious speech impediment, made it very difficult for him to address the nation in a very trying time. And it's all about how, like, the whole country is almost frozen, unable to act because they don't have a leader who can galvanize them with his words, stir them to action, give them a clear direction. So it's about how the whole country is paralyzed because they got a king who can't talk. Okay, and so your kingdom, your domain, is also going to have paralysis if you don't know how to speak properly. Okay, so that's what Proverbs has a lot to say about the way that we speak. That our words, royal speech, should animate, instruct, and ennoble people, lift people up. We live in a voice recognition world. More and more of our technology works by voice recognition. A voice recognition technology is just a small picture of what actually is going on all the time in our world. Your words cause things to happen. Right? The same way you use your phone, you can be like, you know, say, hey Siri, you know, and you can give it, you can have it do, have her do some search for something, right? It's a voice activated thing. Your words make something happen on the phone. Actually, that's the way the whole world works. You talk and stuff happens. So our words have this power, according to the book of Proverbs. Now, some of you even have language-oriented occupations. How many of you have a job where you are required to speak or where you are required to write things that people are going to read in some way? I'd be curious. Yeah. Okay. That's a decent number. There's a lot of people who have, and some of you probably have a job. It's like, it's kind of hard to say. Or if you have to talk to some people throughout the job. So people like you, raise your hand. If you can't talk, you'll blunder your way through your work. Okay. Words shape other people and they bestow blessings and curses. That's why a quiet Christian is good, but a silent Christian is not so good. I understand some of us are by disposition, we're shy, we're very hesitant to talk and let our voice be heard. But according to Proverbs, if you become silent, if you just close your mouth, then you're laying down your weapons, you're laying down your tools, you're giving up a large measure of your power. Okay, so I want to encourage you to speak up and learn ways. According to Proverbs, says again, there's all the list of Proverbs there that you can look up about your speech. And read those and pray about, okay, how can I unleash my speech to bestow blessings on other people? The ideal in Proverbs is not harmless speech. When I was a kid, my parents would always say, if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all. But Christians, that's not an option for us because we do have something nice to say. It's a question whether or not you're saying it or not. You do have something nice to say. It's like, are you going to say it? In Proverbs, there's no proverb in Proverbs that says, if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all. In Proverbs, it says the speech of a righteous man is like a tree of life. It's like a fountain. It's life-giving. It's nourishing. It's like honey. In other words, all these beautiful metaphors that say, like, this is what your speech can be. You got to learn to talk. Like, for some of us, that's like hard to imagine. I'm not here to say, we certainly don't have the time unpack all that and talk about how you could actually go and start to improve your speech. But today I just want us to recognize that's where the power is. You say, how do I become a person of real like power and influence and significance and honor in my world? Like, it's going to have to do with learning to talk. So you're going to have to dig into that and think about that. Proverbs also warns the implication, the father is modeling this for us in Proverbs. The whole book of Proverbs is him speaking to his son. He's saying this is the way of wisdom. So what is it implied that the son is going to go talk about? The way of wisdom. So the same thing the dad is talking about is implied is the same thing the son is going to talk about. So just by reading the book of Proverbs, learn to talk like that. Maybe not in the parallelism. That might freak people out a little bit if you're always talking Hebrew parallelism. But, you know, do your best. Try to make it sound something like the book of Proverbs, right? That we're always speaking God's wisdom to others. You can't speak God's wisdom to others unless you are filled up with God's wisdom. So read things like Proverbs. Read the whole Bible and let it fill you up so that when you're talking, that's the kind of things that are coming out of your mouth, right? Proverbs also warns about the weaponization of our speech, which includes things like flattery, slander, secret telling, and insulting speech. Okay? And I want you to consider, first of all, how the internet aggravates those sins. Okay, there's some of us that we say things on the internet that we would never say in front of other people, right? You're allowing your speech to be weaponized because you're not fighting that battle. You're not seeing the harmful effects it's having on other people. You're sending passive-aggressive messages to people all the time, or you're posting self-pitying posts on, I know, Facebook's not cool. I don't know what y'all using. Something I've never heard of, I'm sure. Like whatever you're posting on, like, you're saying things that are tearing other people down or overly critical of other people on the internet. Things that you wouldn't say in decent company. That's truly. I mean, if anybody could get in a time machine, the thing that would strike them most about our era is the degeneration of human communication. It's just astounding. Like, we've created there's something diabolical going on there, but there's been a realm created where we feel justified, we feel comfortable saying things that you would not feel comfortable saying in any setting 50 years ago. Okay, that your grandparents literally had nowhere they could say, and you've got a place you can say it and feel totally like justified in saying it. It's one other thing I was going to, oh, I wanted to, one other thing here, like with the drunkenness and the gluttony, I wanted to, there's some things here that I want to try to liberate you a little bit about some things. And another one I would want to liberate you about is about the so-called sin of gossip. Everybody knows gossip's a sin. Quit your gossiping. You know, like, but gossip has, people now define gossip as, you said something about me and I wasn't there. That portrayed me in a negative light. You're a gossip. That is not gossip. That is not gossip. It is not gossip to talk about somebody who happens to not be in the room, even if you're talking about them in a negative light. Okay. In the book of Proverbs, the word gossip is associated with two, there are two things that make gossip gossip. Number one is it is slander. It is not true. If you are saying things, you're spreading words about people that are not true. That is the biblical sin of gossip, okay? So don't feel bad, like, oh, you know, I told somebody about my concern about some other person. Was I just gossiping there? No, you probably weren't. Maybe you were, but probably not. Like, was everything you were saying true? It is also sinful for me to get with Chris and start telling him, like, well, I don't know. You know, I see the way Steph's acting. Sometimes I wonder if this isn't what's going on. And I start, like, creating things like that. Yeah, it may not be, my intention may not be to lie or to like invent something, but I'm just speculating, you know, I'm just filling his ear with my speculation. Like, yeah, that can be the sin of gossip. The other thing the book of Proverbs identifies the sin of gossip is betraying confidences. If you told somebody you weren't going to say something, and then you go out and say something, then you're a gossip. And that's something to repent of in the book of Proverbs. So your speech has been weaponized. Now, according to the Bible, not just the book of Proverbs, but there is no, according to Jesus, there is no greater proof of our sinfulness than our speech. You want to construct some evidence for, like, I think people are fallen. Like, where should you start? Start with their speech. And that's one thing, obviously, we see happen in our world. All right, I'm going to tell you one more topic here before we have our next break. And this is about the topic of friendship. Now, before I talk about friendship, I'm going to say there's a couple other topics here that Philip and Roddy thought. So if you disagree with this decision, you can blame them. This is their decision. Yes. You're in the room, aren't you? And it's true. A couple other topics that are very important in the book of Proverbs are raising children and marriage. And they thought that, you know, you guys were served in those topics in other ways, or that we could focus on some other topics for this time. But if I was going to, and it's good too, because if I was going to, This talk is already too crowded, and if I was going to put marriage and raising children in any topic, it would be here with interfacing with the world. Part of what makes you a person of power, strength, and influence is having a big old family, okay? That's why there is more and more pressure on you not to get married and not to have children. That's why the society is putting that pressure on you, because that makes you a powerful person, okay? So, okay, I'm not going to try to dig into all this, but if I was going to dig into this, is what I would say. This is actually not in Proverbs, but there's a psalm, one of the psalms, talks about the man who sits in the gate of the city with all of his sons. So basically the idea is the gates of the city is where the important men of the city would hang out. That's where the business was transacted. That's where you would hang out. And it was like, basically, the idea was like, well, this dude shows up with all of his sons, you have to take him seriously. Like, what are you going to say? Because originally, you go way back to our ancestors, like, a guy with a lot of sons was somebody you couldn't pick on, right? Because you got a bunch of your own sons, like, you have your own, like, little militia, yeah. You know? And so that was power. To have all these children is power. But even today, a family with a whole bunch of kids, that's a family of power. They can help one another. They can support each other. They're there for each other. They love one another, right? They encourage one another. They support each other financially. Like, that's power. That's power. That's why our society doesn't want us to have that, and that's why as Christians we certainly do want to have that. But the last one we're going to look at here is friendship. Interfacing with the world. Friendship. Let's look at chapter 25. Verse 17. Let your foot be seldom in your neighbor's house. Don't be running over your neighbor's house all the time, lest he have his fill of you and hate you. It's an encouraging proverb, right? 25:17. Don't go to your neighbor's house all the time. He's going to get sick of you and hate you. Chapter 27. It probably rhymes in Hebrew. 27:5-6. Better is open rebuke than hidden love. Faithful are the wounds of a friend, but the enemy is kissing you all the time. Verse 9 and 10. Oil and perfume make the heart glad, and the sweetness of a friend comes from his earnest counsel. Do not forsake your friend and your father's friend. And don't go over to your brother's house when you got a calamity. It's better to have a neighbor that's nearby that you're close to than a brother who's far away. Okay, now what should we learn? Proverbs actually has a lot to say about friendship. Again, you can look at the index of Proverbs there, and it'll give you a whole bunch of things you can look at. But interfacing with the world. We don't take on the world by ourselves. We take on the world with our friends. We do not achieve our world-shaping potential all by ourselves. Friends are a decisive factor in our lives. They make us or they break us. So if you look around and you say, I truly do not have friends that will help me out, then you need to be talking to the leaders of your church and be like, what do I need to do so I can have a posse of friends? Like, I need to have some friends to help me out. Friends are a decisive factor in life. Proverbs cautions us. The first proverb we saw there, don't go to your neighbor's house all the time. It cautions us against wearying our friends. Now, you know how I think of myself? I'm vanilla. I'm normal. No one could get sick of me. You can't get sick of water or air or anything that's just a totally normal flavor. But Proverbs is like, no, you're not. No, you're like a pumpkin spice latte. It's like, we want you sometimes, and other times we really don't want you. Like, we're really not in the mood. So, in other words, Proverbs is like, be self-aware. Proverbs is calling you to be self-aware. Like, there's a lot of folks, like, don't we all have friends who literally have no idea, like, the toll that they take on us? Of course we do. They're not even thinking about it at all. You know, they'll just hang out with you for 6 hours, and the thought would never cross their mind that maybe you're getting sick of hanging out. Wouldn't have crossed their mind. Never would have thought about it, right? They're like, oh, I'll just come over to your house, and I'll just stay till like Friday. You're like, yeah, okay, great. That sounds sounds really fun, right? So Proverbs is cautioning you to be self-aware, to be aware that, yes, as wonderful as I am, people could have enough. And I'm aware, Roddy, and I'll quit at the right time. One of the ways that friends, Proverbs also tells us that we shouldn't just be ourselves, right? We should work at actually being a help to other people. One of the reasons that a lot of modern people cannot have friends is that they're so insistent on being themselves, okay? So again, Proverbs is saying like, no. Have it in the realm of possibility in your mind that somebody could have enough of you. And so the answer is not just, well, be myself, right? Or you gotta like, memes constantly being posted on Facebook. Again, I know you're not on Facebook. People constantly posting on Facebook like, if you don't like me the way that I am, if you can't handle me, if I have to change, if someone's asking me to change, then I'd just rather not have a friend like this. Like, okay, you're not going to have any friends. Friends help us with their honest rebuke. Now, be careful of that. I think at a church, a good gospel-centered church like Covenant Life, there can be such a value placed on the open rebuke. Like, oh, I don't want to be that enemy kissing everybody, the profuse kisses of an enemy, so I'm going to be the open rebuke guy. And just walking around like, I love you all, that's I'm going to rebuke you. It's like, okay, he also says it's like, he uses the word perfume. Like, that good advice from a friend is like a perfume. Use perfume sparingly, right? Don't perfume your friends to death with your open rebuke, right? He also uses the word wounds. There are wounds that only a friend can give surgically. There's ways that your friends can help you that no one else is going to help you. I can look over my own life, and I hope you can too. I can look back over my life, and there's just a few friends that have made all the difference. They've wounded me. They've wounded me for the better. He also uses the metaphor of iron sharpening iron, a very famous proverb. That's a metaphor for conversation, as this iron grinds against the iron and makes them both sharper. That's a metaphor for what happens in our conversation with each other. Okay. So if you flee, think about yourself. If you're a person who flees when you are confronted, you'll never be very strong. And I'll say, as a pastor, that's part of the job, to confront people sometimes. It's certainly my least favorite part of the job. And so I've just seen it happen over and over again. I've even seen people like, you can confront them today and they'll humble themselves right now. They'll hear what you say and they're almost taken so much by surprise. They're mortified, they're humiliated that someone they respect has these very negative appraisals of them. And then they'll go home and they'll start to stew. And they'll stew and they'll stew and they'll stew and they'll start to argue. They'll say, that's not true. That's not the way I am. They don't understand me. They don't appreciate me, or they're just thinking of they're believing these lies about me. The next day they're going to blow that relationship up. So again, this Proverbs is warning not to be that person, not to be that person. And I think here at this church, I think you're probably getting pretty good training about how to receive criticism, how to receive rebuke. But that's a very good test for yourself, right? That you can take almost anything. You ask yourself, can I take almost anything? Am I prepared for my friend to say almost anything to me? Okay. Proverbs also shows that we need friends in crisis. Okay. He sends, in other words, God sends situations to us that are too much for us individually. There's nothing that makes me laugh. I'm sorry, Facebook makes me laugh so much. I love it so much because it's just all of our moms sending memes to each other. I just love it. It's the funniest thing. So every day on Facebook, 1 million memes are posted that say, God will never send you something that you can't handle. And every day on Facebook, 1 million memes are posted saying, actually, God will send you something that you can't handle. Like, it's so sick. You guys never seen those things? Yeah, it's constantly. It's like all the Christians saying, God will never send you something you can't handle. God will absolutely send you something you can't handle. Which is it? I would say God will never send you something that you can't handle with the power of his people with you, with his spirit-empowered people alongside of you. Okay. We need friends in a time of crisis. So that last one we read, he says, in the day of crisis, don't go to your brother's house, go to your neighbor's house. Now, what does that mean? A neighbor is somebody that you're living in close community with. Okay. So that, in other words, that's the person I'm with every day. I'm actually, living my life alongside of them. I know them. I have a relationship with them. But a brother, they may live far away. But maybe they're a rich brother. Or maybe they're a powerful, maybe I feel like they owe me. Right, is it not more embarrassing to ask a friend for help than it is to ask a family member for help? Right? Because we kind of feel with our family like they kind of owe it. They kind of owe it. So it doesn't actually humble you at all to ask for help from mom and dad or from a brother or sister, right? You don't have to bring yourself so low, right? But actually, they may actually have a grumbling spirit about like, I'm a dumb kid, I got to help them again out of this problem that they're in, right? There may be a sense of obligation there. But he says, but you have a neighbor next door. If you would humble yourself and go to them and say, your close friend, fellow church member, you know, a good friend that you're close to, someone from a small group, you know, someone that you're close to, and you could go to them, you'd have to humble yourself because you know they don't owe you anything. They know that you know they don't owe you anything. You have to really humble yourself to go. And yet you should. That's where the power is going to be. So we need a friend who will stand with us in our trial. Again, that's the big takeaway from Proverbs about friendship. Friendship is for the time of crisis when it comes. And Proverbs offers us warnings and hints. The time of great crisis is at hand. And we need a friend that sticks closer than a brother, which is, of course, our Lord Jesus Christ. All right. That is our interfacing with the world section.